Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Week. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it the new Superman, David Corenswet? Yes to that last question, no to the first two questions. Plus, we have a little peek into our spoilerific chat with F1 director Joseph Kosinski. All that plus usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. I've noticed that bounder, that cad, that rotter, Phoenix Buchanan, falling asleep in the royal box at Wimbledon this week. Watch out, Paddington! He's after your balls! New balls.
Oh, dear.
Furry, furry balls.
That's rotten.
Bouncy.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, we're in the Pod booth, and I'm joined by, at the moment, two colleagues of such lethal cunning. A photographer who's documenting this for some reason, for posterity or something, and a work experience person called Albie, who is sitting in the corner. Hey, Albie.
Hi.
There you go. That's Albie. I'm not sure if you can pick it up on the microphone or not. James Dyer is not here. We don't know where he's gone. He's legitimately gone AWOL. But we've had to start the podcast without him. But don't worry, because we have some... Well, we got these two idiots. Helen O'Hara is here.
Wow. Hello.
How are you?
Yeah. Well, I argue that we should send Jack Reacher after him. As a former MP, he'd be ideally equipped to find AWOL
as a
people.
Former member of parliament, he would be
military
able to...
Military policeman, yes.
Okay. I thought he was going to, like, you know, write a bill, put it through parliament.
I mean, he could. I believe in him.
Yeah, I believe in him. We could do with a few more Jack Reachers, I think. But Helen O'Hara is here, our geek queen. Hello,
hi,
how
hi,
are
hi.
You?
Good, yeah, good. Yeah.
Good, excellent, excellent, excellent. Alex Godfrey.
Yeah.
Is here.
Hi.
Kneel before Godfrey.
Kneel.
Superman.
This could go on.
It could go on. We probably shouldn't. But hello, Alex. How are you?
I'm super. Thanks for asking.
Okay, good.
That's a very tenuous Superman reference that doesn't work whatsoever.
James, still no fucking clue where he is, which is a real shame because I was hoping James would be here for this week's question.
I know, because it's so him.
It is so him. It is tailored to him in so many, many wonderful ways. I asked people on Twitter for questions. I read their questions. Then I went to Blue Sky and asked people for more questions, and Blue Sky came through. Blue Sky came through this week. It is my new favorite social media platform, and here is one that we're going to be talking about this week. There may be another one we talk about next week.
Okay, excited.
This is one from Ewan Miller, Ewan-Miller on bisky.social, with Superman releasing this week. Who are the best bald baddies?
Ooh.
James Dyer.
So James Dyer, obviously, but I guess we're talking in film.
Yes, in film. The best bald bad guys film.
Well, because James is not here, let's say what James would have said, which is Thanos.
Thanos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Get that out of the way?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, do you think Thanos shaved his head, or was he a victim of male pattern baldness?
I mean, what barber would he go to? What chair? Oh, he's got a throne,
well,
right?
Hang on. You're assuming he ever had hair. I mean, his species may just be...
This is true. What is
he's
he?
A Titan.
Is that a species?
Yeah. Remember, they went to the planet.
Are they all bald?
Well, we don't know. He's the only one. Well, actually, no, his brother, Harry Styles, has hair.
Is that his brother or his half-brother? Eros.
Thanos and his brother, Harry Styles. This is the pocket universe for you.
Has Thanos' hair only been going in one direction? Oh, and is that what makes him beautiful? and I'm out of One Direction songs.
Story of your life.
That was one.
Is that another one?
One is, was yeah. the name of a band, yeah, and one was a song.
Yes, that's correct, Alex. Well done. You're keeping up. Like, it's okay. Good to see. If anyone's keeping score at home, Alex is keeping up.
Back of the net.
That's good. Thanos. Yeah?
Yeah. Yep. Right. Undeniably evil. Definitely. He's not here. He's not here.
He's a climate campaigner.
Is he evil? Would you say?
Yes.
Okay. What about his actions?
Torturing his daughter.
Killing half of the universe's population.
Mm.
All right. But as Meatloaf once said, two out of three ain't bad.
But those are both bad.
Oh,
so
are
two
both
out
bad.
Of three are bad. So
okay.
He's bad.
There's got to be we've got to find some good in him. There's some good in him. I have felt it.
I would do anything for love, but I would not extinguish 50% of the universe's population.
Mm. I think I would.
He threw his other daughter off a cliff also.
Okay. Yeah. The evidence is stacking up against him.
Yeah.
At the moment.
What is the defense?
I don't...
You brought it up.
Well, that he helped bring the whales back to Hudson Bay thing. River Hudson.
As we've discussed, and don't make
River,
me start again on this. Don't make
Hudson.
Me start, but as we've discussed...
At this point, you don't have to say anything. You can just hand your laminated screed around and we can read it out.
It is not sustainable to just wipe out half of every population.
He just does it every 10 years.
It's
like a census, but it's like an opposite of a census.
He's supposed to be setting up a sustainable solution. That isn't a sustainable solution. Plus, if you remove half of all things at the top of the food chain, that actually screws the entire food chain. It doesn't just
He hasn't
balance.
Thought this through.
He hasn't thought it through.
And that is why he's evil.
He's pretty evil, yeah.
Yeah, because he hasn't thought it through. Mm. I will say, before we get more into this question, that this is not being Harrist or Baldist in any way, this question.
No, we could quite easily do bald heroes at the same time.
We could do bald heroes, but I think it's because this is following on from last week's question, which was about the best British villains in movies. And so this person, who may have hair, I don't know. Maybe this person is Harrist. I honestly don't know. Ewan Miller, clicking on his profile right now, he has hair.
Wow.
He has hair,
so
but he's following on from that. Maybe he is Harrist or Baldist. No, you're Baldist. If James were here, I'd say that, but he's not here.
He's still missing. It's very strange.
It is very, very strange. We will report on his whereabouts and life situation as the podcast goes on.
So anyway,
but we're not being Baldist. With this question, we're not being bald.
No.
That's the thing I'm trying to say, because, you know, I'm racing rapidly in that direction. Alex, how's your hair?
Yeah. It's still pretty bouffant.
You're holding manfully on to it.
Thank you.
Should I say?
What's left is fine.
Yeah. And this is not to say that bald men are diminished in any way, shape, or form.
Look at the entire cast of Fast and Furious, a series
Precisely.
Of films that we very much enjoy.
We very much enjoy them. Look at Thanos.
Just look at him.
Look at him. He's thick
again,
and swole.
Well, we don't know that he comes from a species that even had hair to begin with. I'm just saying.
But he is. You cannot argue with the fact he's bald.
I don't.
All right. Okay. So let's have another bald villain.
How about, like, original flavor Blofeld, right?
I beg your pardon.
And then Dr. Evil is a sort of adjunct of that.
Dr. Evil?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Don Logan.
Don Logan, very scary.
The sweariest bald villain.
Yeah.
And genuinely terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Very, very good call.
Don Logan.
No. Oh, my God. He's alive! He's alive!
I have a mouthful of banana bread.
He's alive!
Oh, sorry, James. James's excuse for being late is that he's been eating banana bread.
Yes, James.
I'm not more helpful if you got lights.
Welcome.
Yeah.
We were worried.
Like 20 minutes. That was not ideal.
We were worried you might be dead.
No, I am ill.
Oh. Oh, my. James's arm has just come off.
Just in time for the photo. Hooray! Welcome to the Empire Podcast.
I'm wearing my headphones.
Oh, my word.
I am as
well. You are too, yeah.
He's come in like an agent of chaos.
I know, I am.
All right.
Oh, God.
We're talking about bald villains and the zip of magic. Here you are. We genuinely thought you were dead.
I had literally no idea that we'd overrun, like absolutely no
idea.
What do
you mean? You had no idea the pilot had overrun?
Yeah, no idea. We'd overrun by half an hour nearly, and I hadn't even realised. And I think it's because I ate before the podcast, so normally my hunger would have driven me from the studio.
Is it because you weren't listening?
I mean, there's that too.
And this, I don't know, it's a crazy new invention. I don't know whether you've heard of it. It's called a watch. have you heard of
you're
it?
You're wearing one.
Yeah.
Are you aware of it?
On your arm.
I do see the problem.
Yeah.
I see what went wrong.
Yeah, yeah. You went wrong.
Yeah, I did very much go wrong, yeah.
Anyway, we introduced you. It was great. Yeah. You weren't here. It
well,
was your funniest intro
Superman
yet.
Well, I slacked off Superman on pilot as well. So actually, I've
did
kind
you?
Of done, I've done
did
my
you?
Part already.
Okay,
yeah,
good. So. All right. So we were talking about bald villains.
Yes.
Thanos has been mentioned.
Oh,
I tried to defend him. I tried to argue for him, but Helen said quite rightly that he's evil. I said, well, why? How is he evil? She said he threw his daughter off a cliff. I said, all right, fair enough.
It is hard to argue with that, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. And also, he's been very bad at admin. We discovered this.
Indefensible.
Yeah. So have a little think. You just calm yourself down there,
okay,
and have a little think about bald villains who aren't Thanos
or Blofeld.
Alex said Don Logan, but Helen said Blofeld and Dr. Evil, and we didn't talk about those characters.
Okay,
so let's talk a little bit more about Blofeld and Dr. Evil.
I mean, I don't know what their baldness adds, except to create a visual contrast, I suppose, between them and the guys that they're fighting.
But James Bond has a lot of hair.
Yeah,
some of it's real.
Indeed, does you know Austin Powers.
The irony, and this may be an Alanis-level irony, is that Sean Connery probably had the same amount of hair when he was shooting You Only Live Twice as Donald Pleasance, who was playing Blofeld.
One had a hair wig and one had a bald wig.
Precisely. And Telly Savalas was bald. He was a proper bald.
Okay.
As Blofeld in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. Charles Gray, his Blofeld had hair. Mm-hmm. Charles Gray, not bald.
Didn't the most recent one also have
Christoph
hair?
Waltz.
Yeah. Christoph Waltz.
Yeah. Think he had hair too?
He was hairy.
I forget.
He
didn't make an impression.
He did.
Not on me.
Yeah.
Well, but he's the author of All Your Pain.
I am the author of... Oh, no, that's for a talk. Anyway, yeah.
I'm
the author of... Oh, no, that's Peter Lorre.
Oh, no.
He'd be great as Blofeld, wouldn't he? Mr. Bond.
No, stop it.
Or Mr. Bond, I am the author of All Your Pain. See, Helen, you've just taken your headphones off your ears, but then they've exposed your ears. So you can still hear me.
No, I couldn't with my fingers in my ears.
All right,
so
very clever.
Okay.
Blofeld's great. Dr. Evil's fantastic.
Yeah, he is wonderful.
Iconic bald villain. Alex, you were saying Don Logan.
I was saying Don Logan. I fucking love Don Logan. That wasn't intentional, but it is appropriate.
Okay.
Don Logan is so scary that you are terrified of him before you see him, just by the way that other people are talking about him. There's that great dinner scene where they are told that he is in the vicinity or on the way. And Ray Winston, terrifying hard man himself, basically shits himself
at the dinner table.
And then when Don Logan does arrive in just this mad, energetic bluster, just gets off the plane, I think his first words are something, I'm sweating like a c-. But yeah, he's a little guy in a little white shirt and he's terrifying and he is, I think the baldness doesn't hurt.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a guy who won't be distracted by having to put gel in his hair or comb his hair. He will just spend all of his time fucking you up.
Yeah, there's the scene in the bathroom in the mirror where he's looking at himself and basically having a bit of a mental breakdown with himself. And
you know,
there's something about that chrome dome that's quite terrifying.
I think it's just bald Ben Kingsley's terrifying.
Sir Ben Kingsley. Yes.
Let's start that again, shall we?
Gandhi will fuck you up.
Yeah. He will.
Yeah, faster than a bullet. Should we discuss Lex Luthor? Because I think that's what really inspired this week's question. There was also last week's question that inspired this question, but we are in the week of the re-release of Superman. Nick Holt did shave his head for this role.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Holt in Fury Road is a great bald villain, right?
Is he a villain?
He's kind of a villain. Well, he's a war boy.
Witness him.
How's he a villain? He's a hero. He's one of the good guys.
He becomes one of the good.
He's a foot soldier. He's not like a villain.
Well, you could say that about the Nazis.
You could say that about most of the Nazis, but not the ones at the top. What I'm saying is he's like a foot soldier.
You can still be an evil foot soldier, though.
He's not evil at any point in that movie.
He's part of the evil gang sent to do evil things.
Hey, if Thanos taught us anything, it's the villains don't need to be evil.
Thanos didn't teach us anything, James. Am I wrong about this? Have I got it wrong?
Look, I guess we can push the point, but I'm kind of with Chris. Like, he ends up as a goody.
Not even ends up. He very quickly changes sides and, you know, makes a noble sacrifice.
Yes. Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Well.
At the end of that film. And he's great. Nux is very much...
Max as a blood bag, which is frowned upon.
But it's not his choice to use Max as a blood bag. He is given Max as a blood bag. He is bought into the Morton Joe's doctrine and he believes every single word that he's been fed. Then over the course of the movie, and very quickly indeed, after the sandstorm, his eyes are opened. And he even has a little relationship with one of the wives, one of the Morton Joe's wives, the five wives.
When presented with any alternative, he quickly grabs hold of
it. He does.
I sidetracked us here terribly. We were talking about Lex Luthor, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mr. Luthor.
Quite a lot of good comic book bald villains, actually. Maybe because of Lex, who I think was the first of them. But, you know, Bullseye, Kingpin.
Fucking gorgeous.
Kingpin, yeah. Kingpin, amazing on TV.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Lex probably was the original and... I don't know what best, but he's the original.
He's not really bald in Richard Donner's first Superman film, is he?
He is bald. He takes his wig off at the end.
At the end, isn't that?
Yeah.
In prison?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He snatches it off proudly. The reason for that, of course, being Gene Hackman refused to shave his head for the role.
Yeah, he also refused at first to shave his moustache until Richard Donner encouraged him to.
That's right, yeah.
Are we still doing Lex? We got more Lexes?
I think that the Nicholas Holt Lex is a pretty cool, bald guy. Like, he's got the head for
it. He wears it well.
He looks good.
Yeah.
We know now from Nicholas Holt's recent peroxide do that he kind of looks good, whatever he does.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
He does. It's annoying.
Yeah, yeah, bastard.
See, if I shaved my hair off, they'd push me in the sewers.
This is what worries me because, you know, as we said, I'm rapidly going this way. James has been bald ever since I met him. But James has got, you know, as we've discussed in podcasts before, he reminds me of Terry Gilliam's quote about Bruce Willis. His bald head is a monument to cranial architecture. It looks good. I'm giving you a compliment here.
Thank you.
It's killing me.
Making me very uncomfortable.
It's killing me. And I'm maintaining eye contact with you throughout.
It's weird.
It looks good. I'm worried if I shave my head, what lies beneath will be some sort of Caliban-esque misshapen monstrosity. Yeah, that I'll resemble the craters of the moon and it'll be awful. Or I'll look like Michael Berryman in The Hills of Eyes. I don't want that to be the case.
Maybe we should bring back, what is it called, phrenology or something, where they would try and... You know,
yes, by the bumps on your head.
Yeah, they would tell your character by bumps on your head. And you know, at least in the disc world, presumably then, by creating new bumps on your head, you can change someone's character. So we can just hit you over the head with a hammer.
please do.
Until you make sense.
But I don't invite the listeners. I invite you two, only my trusted friends, not you two. They would be terrible at hitting me with hammers.
Maybe they'd be good. I mean,
maybe they would.
Larry could do it.
Larry, he'd be great at hitting people over the head with hammers. Alex, you have a wonderfully tall, thin head. So I think your bald head would be good.
Thanks.
But I think you might have a lot of capacity at the back. It might look like like the leader.
Did it start out as a compliment?
It has strayed from the path.
The leader.
I would say.
Misshapen, elongated.
No, 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 no. No, no, the leader, the leader, not as he is in Captain America Brave New World, which is not great, the makeup job on Tim Blake Nelson, but the leader as he is in the comic books, where he's got this great big noggin, and it looks lovely.
I don't want to walk around looking like the leader.
People might follow you.
They might.
They might. Taking pictures from behind.
Favorite Lex Luthor?
No.
Gene Hackman?
Yeah.
Obviously.
Well.
Wrong! It's not Kevin Spacey, by the way.
It's
but,
definitely not Kevin Spacey.
Any votes for Jesse Eisenberg?
No,
I do think his scheme was clever in BVS.
Is that how you rate your Lexes by the schemes?
Genuinely, I think the scheming is important. It's an important Lex factor. So,
factor.
I think the one in Smallville, Michael Rosenbaum, he went up and down a bit, but I think he was generally quite a good Lex.
It was a very different reading of that character.
Very different,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. It's to the extent where he is not Luthor Corp, is he? He's Lex Corp, and it's his dad, Lionel Luthor, who's Luthor Corp.
Even more of a dick.
That's right, yeah.
But I enjoyed Nicholas Holt very much. We'll get to that.
I also enjoyed
the performance of that character.
Dear God.
Hey, how about Nosferatu? Original flavor.
Where?
And 70s flavor.
Count Orlok.
Yeah.
Count Orlok's pretty terrifying. There are a lot of famously bald horror villains. Mm. Why do movies equate baldness with evil?
I mean, they do.
We've just given you a litany of bald baddies.
Yeah, but there's also like every Jason Statham film, pretty much. There's, apart from maybe Fast 6, but then everybody else in the Fast movies is bald. You've got anything Patrick Stewart has done, practically.
I would say there are more.
Yul Brynner, Bruce Willis. There are a huge number of bald heroes.
Well, Yul Brynner, terrifying baldy in Westworld.
Admittedly.
Patrick Stewart, terrifying baldy in Green Room.
Okay, but mostly...
A force for good.
A force for good. is okay. What I'm saying. Bruce Willis, mostly a force for good.
Jason Statham,
mostly a force for good.
Okay, but there are evil baddies in horror films.
Yeah.
Freddy Krueger, for example, doesn't have long, luscious locks. Now, in fairness, as a human, he did have hair.
He did.
Unfortunately, it was burned off in that fire.
Yeah.
But so he does. He is bald.
Unfortunately, what a shame.
Unfortunately,
sad story.
Well, unfortunately for him, from his point of view, it was most unfortunate.
Oh, here we go. Thanos all over again.
Oh boy!
I am not defending Freddy Krueger.
Heavily misunderstood.
No.
I am not defending Freddy Krueger at all. He deserved it. Jason Voorhees.
What about
Bane?
Bane.
Can I drag us out of genre for a second and just say a properly scary evil character is Edward Norton's Derek Vinyard in American History X.
Oh, God, yes. Yeah. But also the hero of that film.
Well, hang on.
Context.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true, though, isn't it?
Protagonist. Sure.
Though he does have hair by the time he becomes the hero.
I don't think he becomes the hero. He tries to be good. I don't know if you would call him the hero.
I think he's the hero
of that narrative. He's the center. He goes through a redemptive arc as that film goes along.
But he also
introduces someone's teeth to a curb in a very unfortunate way. Mm. But I think when he is bald, he is definitely the villain. And when he comes out of prison and has hair, he is the goody. So quite clearly, that is the arc showing you that baldness makes you villainous and growing hair is your redemption arc.
Well, if you say so.
Unfortunately for you, I remain in my villain era.
One for you, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
I thought of you.
Thanks, man.
Terence Fletcher in Whiplash.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, but is he a villain or is he just looking for excellence?
He's just a teacher.
He's just a perfectionist.
He wants the best for his students.
That is my fucking tempo. That's a great choice. Whoa, what a belter on which to end. I enjoyed that. And I have seen another question that I would like us to pursue on next week's show that is coming from Blue Sky. So don't send in any more questions just yet. But what you can do is buy some tickets to see us live.
Yes.
So tickets went on sale last week. We are coming to you live as part of the London Podcast Festival on Saturday, September 13th. Unlucky for you guys. At King's Place London, our spiritual home. Tickets went on sale last week, are selling very, very well indeed. But we'd obviously like to sell out. If we sell out, then we can look at offering a streaming service for lists of people who can't make it on the night. We'll be able to see the show live. That is important because, as ever with our London podcast festivals and with many of our live shows, in fact, this is a one-off show. This is a bespoke show. This will be an evening with the Empire podcast and will not be released on the podcast feed. So the only chance you have to experience it is either live, buying tickets via kingsplace.co.uk, or streaming, should we get to that point. So there you go. kingsplace.co.uk, and also buy tickets for Pilot 350, which is, James, how long to go now?
It's just a month. August the 8th, Friday, August the 8th.
Do you have a guest yet?
I'll be there.
In a succession of wigs.
I will be there, putting on a variety of accents that somehow all sound the same. Yes, there will be guests. We had a meeting about that today, where there will be desperate shout-outs going out to all the famous people we know. But I'm sure we will have guests and all sorts of exciting things as well.
Hurrah. That's exciting. I also have to put out some panicked shout-outs to publicists for a guest for our live show. So that'll be a lot of fun. That'll be exciting. All right. Shall we have a guest?
Please.
Shall we have Superman?
Superman!
Yay!
Superman! Superman!
So James Gunn's Superman opens this week in cinemas, opens today, in fact, as you listen to this, the 11th of July, and it is the latest big screen iteration of Superman, and that means we have a new Superman. Henry Cavill is no longer the possessor of the cape and the little undies that go over his trousers, although Cavill didn't wear those in fairness. It is now David Corenswet, who is in possession of the great S cape. And he is very good in this movie, indeed. Very wholesome, very likable, very relatable. He is a very, very lovely man to speak to, as I discovered when I went along to speak to him at the Superman junket at a top London hotel. The Shangri-La in the Shard. That's where the Superman is suspended. The Superman
Gorian Shard?
No, sadly, they did not follow through. So the giant Superman is suspended in between the towers of the Shard at the moment in London. Still there, right?
I believe so.
You can see that. It's very, very cool. David Corenswet had just been on the very top of the Shard just mere minutes before we spoke. And that is one of the things we speak about in this very fun interview with the new Superman. Here we go. David Corenswet. Enjoy.
We're delighted to be joined in the Emperor podcast by David Corenswet, Superman himself.
Oh, I love sir. Hearing my name, that my last name is best said with a slight English accent, so thank you.
What about with Superman following immediately afterwards?
Yeah, that's okay? Not too bad. It's not a bad way to live.
Are you still getting used to that?
I'd say I've given up on getting used to it, and I'm just going to let it continue happening. And it's a bizarre thing to hear or to say out loud. Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, you were just up in the building, on the top of the building,
right at the top. We're in the, and actually, shard. I'm still up there.
You're still up there.
Yeah, they left me up there.
Yeah,
dangling between the spires.
How was that for you?
Oh, pretty cool
up there. Yeah.
Yeah, I love. I got to take flying lessons for about a year, so I flew small planes mostly over LA.
Okay.
And the perspective you get from just a couple thousand feet in the air really is quite a magical experience.
Yeah.
So getting to see that view of London is pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. So you took flying lessons, not in preparation for this role.
No, unrelated. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm guessing you have a head for heights, because it would have been wild if Superman had been up there on top of the shard and then had a panic attack. Whoa. Like Chris Reeve does in Switching Channels. I don't know if you've ever seen that film.
Oh, no, I haven't.
No, he has a panic attack in an elevator.
There
elevator,
you go. But. Well, I don't think I'm above a panic attack in an elevator, but heights seem to be okay. Small spaces plus heights. That's part of the reason I was excited about taking flying lessons, because when you're flying a very small plane, you've got the height, but you've also got the claustrophobia. So I figured I'd just knock all the phobias out in one experience.
So have you had a heights thing in your life?
I don't think so. Not that I can remember. Probably when I was young and I did some kind of, outdoorsy ropes course, where you're walking on a rope only about 10 or 15 feet off the ground. That was probably pretty. But when you're on a building, or you have a plane underneath you, so it doesn't get to me so much.
How close were you to the edge?
I looked right down over the edge. I like to push my luck.
And how nervous were the suits at Warner Brothers when you did that?
Oh, no, they were very happy. As they said, as long as you don't hold anything out over the edge, we're fine.
You didn't want to drop a coin.
Yeah, no.
And then test that old that old legend.
I couldn't afford it.
Oh, come on. But there's so much to talk about this role. This is a role that effectively you manifested.
People keep saying this, and it's the one thing that I push back on.
Okay.
I
super manifested.
That's very good. I haven't heard that yet. All that's right. Very good. I inversely manifested it. When I was asked about it, the quote that people are referring to, which was about 6 years ago, I was asked whether I was aware of people's impression that I had sort of a Superman look about me.
Yeah.
And at that point, I meant to sort of dismiss the idea, because it felt a bit too big for my britches to say, like, yes, I know that people think I'm like Superman. But when it was said to me, it did occur to me that it would be an amazing role to get to play at some point. But it felt completely impossible. I mean, it was the kind of, it was like somebody said, like, have you ever thought about wanting to go to the moon? So, I mean, sure. Yeah. I mean, if somebody, it's never going to happen, but sure. Yeah. So at that moment, it was very much not a goal. It was not on my to-do list or my bingo card. It was something that I sort of had to think about because enough people had mentioned it to me. Mm. But I mostly tried to keep it out of my mind, because you certainly don't want to get wrapped up in ideas of, grandeur when you're a working actor and you're struggling and you're hoping desperately that the phone will call a couple times a year, with a small job here or there. So to dream of something as big as this was not my style back then, so, and today either.
You're absolutely right. It is a little counterintuitive to when the job comes up. To go, oh, I could play that role. Mm. But inherently, that's not Superman. To think I could be Superman is to not be Superman, if you know what I mean.
I hope that there's something to
with that.
No, I like the idea of that. Not a reluctant hero. I think one of the great things about Superman as a character, and a thing that sets him apart, distinguishes him from a lot of other great superhero characters, is that he doesn't feel so much like he carries a burden or that he bears a heavy responsibility. It's a joyous responsibility for him. It's the thing that makes him happiest in the world, is that he has these powers that allow him to show up and put people at ease and save the day and and inspire people. And it's a great gift to have that kind of energy. And people have that energy too. You know, if you're lucky enough to be one of those people, when you show up in a situation, everybody else sort of breathes a sigh of relief, like, oh, that person's here. Yeah. You know, nothing can go that wrong.
I'm the opposite of that.
Just you walk in the room, something's going to go wrong. Surely,
he's not him again.
You know, I have that depending on which room I'm walking into. Give me one or the other. But yeah, I think I certainly hoped that. Well, no, I didn't. Looking back on it, there's a nice sort of synergy with the idea that I really never thought that I was going to play Superman, even when my agent called me and said in this sort of controlled, excited, you know, I think you know what this is about, the Superman audition. It's kind of like, oh, okay, so we're here now. In some ways, I felt sad at that point because it had been so fun having this joke with my friends and family and my agent of like, oh, if they ever remake Superman, you know, maybe it'll be you. And then once the audition came around and it was all becoming real, I thought for sure that it wasn't going to be me. And so that was going to kind of close the door on this fun little game, this fantasy game we had been playing. I said that to my wife, that there was a sadness I felt in that we were going to close the door on this chapter, thinking that with most roles, you know, just the odds are against you, and it's unlikely. In this case, I sort of thought impossible that it would be me.
But you sent a letter to James Gunn with your self-tape, your first self-tape for this role. Do you remember any of the contents of that letter?
That's a great question. I should go back and reread it. The gist of it was, I was writing about the idea that I had, the sense that I had that Superman is a sort of had been a misunderstood character, especially in the public eye. Not so much by the people who contributed to his canon over the years, but in the public eye, that he could be misunderstood as being boring or difficult to relate to or difficult to care about because he's thought of as kind of invincible, and then also doesn't have the internal struggle of feeling this great burden or having a traumatic childhood. So one thrust of the letter was talking about this, the way that I related to the idea of the character of Superman, which was through his through the juxtaposition between his great joy and what he's able to do, the lightness with which he goes about saving the city and the world and playing the character of Clark Kent, and a loneliness that's connected to that, where he takes such joy in connecting to humanity, but ultimately knows that he's not one of them. Mm-hmm. And that I related to, I think, a very universal experience we've all had of being in a room of people and feeling lonely. And the paradox there. That was the thrust of the letter. But I should go back and reread it and remind myself. It's not exactly what James wanted for the character. It's funny. It's not like when we with the version of the character we ended up with. It's not like I would go back to that letter and think, oh, I knew exactly. I happened to guess it exactly.
Yeah.
But I think the spirit of the thing. In addition, I think that the spirit of having a point of view and having a perspective, it turned out that James is the kind of director who really appreciates and counts on his actors and his department heads and all the people he brings into the fold to come in with strong perspective and to be willing to share it and to go out on a limb for it, knowing that ultimately he's got to be in charge and he's got to filter what fits with the vision and what doesn't. But he really relies on and takes great advantage of great craftspeople and artists who bring their best work to him.
Well, the film obviously is a very, very fresh take on Superman and doesn't do what previous Superman movies have done before. We don't get the origin story. We don't get to see Clark meet Lois for the first time. He drops us right into a world that is already fully formed and a Superman that's fully formed as well. And I haven't timed it with the stopwatch, David, but I think I'm right in this. You spend more time in the Superman suit in this movie than any other actor has in any other Superman movie.
That sounds right to me.
And what was that like for you? You know, because you don't really get to play the bumbling Clark Kent that much, or as much as people might think that you were going to. So
yeah, well, I it reflects my experience shooting the film as well, because usually when I'm in the Superman suit, we're doing an action sequence or some flying or you know, when you're shooting those sequences, you spend a lot longer getting a lot less film, essentially. You'll spend all day getting about 3 or 4 seconds of the final picture. Whereas when I'm in my Clark getup, the interview scene with Rachel, you know, we shot 10% of the movie in 2 days, which was about 2% of our shoot days.
Yeah.
So I got very comfortable in the suit. I got used to putting it on. There's a little bit of an element of putting on a wet bathing suit after you've, you know, taken it off, where every time you get into it, it's a little, there's a little element of, I don't know, getting back to it in not so good a way. But then once you're in it and you're back to fighting, back, you know, back in the pool, it's fantastic. And you really get used to living in it in a way that feels comfortable. May not quite be the word, but you feel settled in it.
I always ask people about day one, especially on a movie this big, with a role this big. Was day one a Superman suit day?
Day one was a Superman suit day in I wish I knew it in Celsius, but about 4 degrees Fahrenheit out lying in the snow in the Arctic in Svalbard, Norway. So it was a pretty intense first day.
So that's presumably one of the times you're beaten up.
Yeah.
So not feeling very Superman.
Just about the first shot of the film is where we started. Well, James and I talked a lot about this. You know, part of the fun of getting to spend so much of the film in the Superman suit is we get to explore a lot of the different states that Superman can be in. We get to swoop in and save the day quite a bit, but we also get to have our asses kicked. And starting there, in some ways, was difficult because I was working with an invisible dog a lot of the time. But in those cases, it's very helpful to have real cold. It's hard to pretend two things at the same time. I could pretend the dog that wasn't there, but if I had also had to pretend to be cold, that would have been rough. But that's, I mean, one of the reasons James wanted to start there was to establish the wide range of experiences you were going to go through with Superman in this film. And I think beaten and bloodied, lying in the snow, you know, really needing a rescue from a best friend, I don't think we've seen that, at least we haven't started with a Superman in that position yet. So it definitely, it sets the tone immediately.
What was your first strapping Superman hero day?
So once we got back to, it really, in the Arctic, it only got worse from there. I started lying in the snow and ended up getting dragged through the snow. So it was bad to worse. But once we got back to Atlanta, the first week was these 2 days with Rachel for the interview scene, and then 2 days of sort of not quite finding my feet, literally, no pun intended, but literally on a blue screen on a stage, doing a lot of flying bits, just pieces where I would be flying through the air, tumbling, a little fight piece here and there, which was good for the stunt team to kind of get their legs under them. And then the last day of the first week was the first day that I got to combine the two, and we had a sort of a scene that was in the Superman suit. There was a little bit of flying, a little bit of action, but it felt like a real character moment. It was me checking on bystanders. We have this great big action moment, and then I take a second to make sure that everybody's safe and feeling okay. And that's when, for me, I felt like, all right, great. That's the spirit of this character. So locked in.
How did you approach that sort of dichotomy of Superman? Because the Clark we see with Lois in private and Superman are essentially the same guy. But there is the other side of Clark as well, the bumbling Clark.
Yeah.
So how did you approach that side of things? And do you think that Clark in private is exactly the same as Superman? Or once he puts on the suit, does he change?
No, definitely there's something presentational that happens when he puts on the suit. He wants to symbolize, in the same way that I've described a firefighter or a paramedic or a nurse or a doctor. You know, they're human and they're going to have their doubts and their uncertainties. But for the most part, when they're on the job, when they're showing up to save the day, they're going to put those insecurities and those uncertainties on the back burner, because part of the job is to convey calm and reassurance. And I think the same is true for Superman when he's in the suit.
Mm-hmm.
Clark, the real Clark, who plays both of these characters, I think has all of the flavors of both of them. He feels a little awkward and bumbling sometimes, but he also has the confidence of knowing and, you know, being Superman. the character that he plays at the Daily Planet is a lot of fun, just because it is, I think, ultimately Clark kind of cosplaying as a journalist, as a human being. It is for fun. He gets a certain amount out of having that alter ego to maybe get at a story in a way that Superman wouldn't be able to. But mostly it's about having these relationships, nourishing himself, feeling connected to humanity, reminding himself what it feels like to be human. It's one of the things that superheroes can struggle with is forgetting what it's like to not have these powers and not have this role in society and just be a regular guy putting on his shoes, going to work in the morning. I think Clark really enjoys, you know, taking the train to work and being late and getting, you know, yelled at for that.
he feels like human.
Yeah, it keeps him human, which is his favorite thing to do.
I love that idea that Clark plays Superman and Clark plays Clark as well. So would Clark be a good actor? Do you think he could do All My Sons? Or?
Oh, that's a guy. I think he'd struggle with somebody else's dialogue. He's not so good when somebody else is writing his dialogue. But he'd love to give it a go, that's for sure.
He'd be good at improv.
Yeah, I think he's very good. He's got to be, yeah.
That's amazing. I've got to go in a second, David. But I saw that amazing interview you did with Ben Mankiewicz.
Oh, yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Thanks for watching. It was fantastic. Did it come up at all that he's the cousin of Tom Mankiewicz, who co-wrote the first Superman?
Yeah, we talked about it a little ahead of time. The first thing that connected us, he remarked at the fact that I was a Marx Brothers fan. And I think I'm going to forget, but I think it was his father or someone like the grandfather who wrote for the Marx Brothers, co-wrote some of the Marx Brothers' more famous movies. I think it was Horse Feathers, Day at the Races. So that was where we connected. Obviously, we were there for Superman, but he was so astonished to see that in my Playbill bio, as a 9-year-old, I had written that I was a fan of the Marx Brothers.
That is amazing. The very last thing is, in that interview, you talk about how you've woken up for the last 5 years to the strains of John Williams' Raiders March, which is a very, very good choice. Superman theme's pretty good as well, you know, the way it builds slowly. Have you ever done that? Have you ever woken up to the soothing strains of Superman's theme?
Now that you mention it, I have a vague memory. I can't know whether this is true or not, but I have a vague memory either on the day of my screen test or maybe on the first day of shooting, I set my alarm as the John Williams Superman theme. Because I did feel, whichever day it was true, I didn't feel like Superman, and I sort of felt like I was showing up to work unprepared in a way that nobody could fully be prepared to show up to play Superman. And you know, it's John Williams' music that is sort of that, it's the reason that I felt like I could be a Jedi when I was a kid. You know, when you're watching the movies, that it's the music that sort of tricks you into thinking that you're in the world and that you belong there.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful that we have such a great score for this film. I'm really excited to hear it all together.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, whatever you did, it worked.
Oh,
so,
bless.
Brilliant. Thanks,
David. Thank you so much.
Hello. I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save with customized coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping.
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Okay, that was David Corn-Sweat. We'll be talking about Superman later on in the show, folks. Now it is time to discuss this week's movie news. It's not a lot.
No, it's a very quiet week. I think people July had the 4th. July 4th weekend off. And
lazy.
Look, I didn't want to say lazy. I was thinking it.
I'm saying it.
Okay.
I'm saying they're lazy. But there has been some movie news.
There has been movie news.
Some of it's very sad, but some of it's very, we'll get to that at the end. A few people did pass away during the week, but there's some good stuff. What were you going to say?
I was going to say the very important news that there is an official title for June 3.
Yeah.
I had
what is it, Helen?
It's the last thing you would have expected. It's Dune Part 3.
How do you think they came up with it?
I think it must have taken sleepless nights.
Mm.
And a lot of whiteboard usage.
I'm going to get, I said that on this very podcast, that, I assume it will be called Dune Part 3. And you were all just like, why do you say that? Why do you think that? It will be Dune Messiah, surely. I don't know why I thought that. I just kind of assumed that this is what he'd go with. Although whenever I've discussed it with him, he's referred to it as
Messiah. He being Denis Villeneuve.
Denis Villeneuve, yes. But I always assumed that this would be Dune Part 3. I think mainly because of the way Dune Part 2 ends, in that it doesn't. And it feels like this is the completion of a single story as opposed to a sequel.
So yes.
I think I always thought it would be a Part 3.
Interesting. So that was your, what's your equivalent of a You Better Believe It, Buddy, or an Amon Guarantee?
Normally a dire warning. Yeah.
So that was a dire warning. And one that came true. So well done, you.
Hooray! I am one for one.
Dune Part 3. Is that really the best we got to talk about this week?
Yes.
I mean,
it's the only news
we
need.
There was room. There was news that a new writer has been attached to National Treasure 3. Which
Jesus Christ.
That is anti-news.
It does feel like
don't
a little bit.
Don't you come for National Treasure.
Well, I'd like to come for National Treasure because then I'd be rich, rich beyond my wildest dreams.
You
but
would.
No.
Well, tough. You'd have to fight Chris Bremner for the privilege, who worked on Bad Boys for Life and Ride or Die.
You say no more.
Yeah, he's in.
He's apparently in. So, you know, I mean, there's probably worse things.
Helen, it hasn't come to this. We can't discuss this. That's a nonsense. I have stories.
Okay, bring a story.
I have stories. Don't worry. I'm going to save you guys. No, that's rubbish. No, that's rubbish too. I've got some casting news.
Oh.
All right, some casting news. So, Michael B. Jordan, is moving ahead with his Thomas Crown Affair, right?
Ooh.
Great.
And we talked last week about how Kenneth Branagh is ramping up his acting after years of directing and being Poirot, although he was acting there as well, in fairness. Not bald.
No.
No, hair.
He's never
also
been bald.
Also not a villain.
No, not a villain.
Never seen him bald.
Anyway, think on that. Anyway, he's going to be in The Devil Wears Prada 2. He's also going to be in The Thomas Crown Affair, as is Lily Gladstone. So that is some interesting casting news. Also, in other interesting casting news, in terms of The Devil Wears Prada 2, Simone Ashley has joined the cast of that movie, and hopefully, unlike in F1, won't get entirely cut out.
Okay, so okay, that's interesting.
Yeah,
she could be a kind of successor to the Emily Blunt role. Who's Branagh? Is he the psychiatrist? Or is Lily Gladstone the psychiatrist? She'd be good.
What are you? How do you mean?
In Thomas Crown Affair.
As in the one that Michael B. Jordan has a relationship with. They're saying Branagh is going to be a villain of some kind.
Okay.
This is interesting. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, we shall see.
I guess.
We shall bloody well see. Simone Ashley, Devil Wears Prada 2, that is happening right now. There's a report going out there as well that Cosmo Jarvis is no longer going to star or be one of the stars of Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey.
Yes.
He has dropped out to be replaced by Logan Marshall Green.
Presumably, the other Tom Hardy lookalike.
Well, that's it. Presumably, they're not even going to bother refilming. If he has filmed anything, they're just going to substitute Logan Marshall Green in, and no one's going to know the
difference. No one will notice. No,
yeah.
Do you think that Cosmo Jarvis looks that much like Tom Hardy? Like Logan Marshall Green, 100%.
I think they are both of them like brilliantly budget Tom Hardys.
Do you
and it's
think?
Great. Yeah.
I think Cosmo Jarvis is his own thing.
Budget Tom Hardy is a bit harsh.
Oh, no, to be fair. They're very good. And Cosmo Jarvis was fantastic in Shogun. I'm throwing no shade at Cosmo
Jarvis.
I'm just saying.
Chameleonic.
He has a Hardy esque.
I don't think so.
Sort of thing going on in the same way that.
I think he's got a sort of. Maybe they share a certain unpredictable, volatile energy. I don't think physically
in that they look
like
the same. Yes,
no, they don't.
In fairness, there are moments. There are moments in Shogun where he does look more Hardy. I will admit that, but he doesn't generally to me. Like in Cam with Horses, he doesn't look anything like it.
That's true.
Or in Alto Nights with that massive neck.
Oh, that was weird.
Yes.
We don't know who he was playing in the first place, do we?
The horse, I think.
I mean, that does explain Alto Nights, I suppose. But no, we don't.
We
know.
Don't know.
How does it explain all the
neck? The neck thing.
Why the long face?
Hey,
come on now.
All right.
That's exciting. That's exciting for Logan Marshall Green, whose career I would say never really quite took off the way that I thought it was going to.
Because there's an actual Tom Hardy. And he gets a lot.
Yeah,
of the
but he did really well in Upgrade, and he never seemed to get a bump out of that.
He did very well.
In fact, he got downgraded.
No, but like. You know,
he's great in that film.
He did well, the film did well, and yet it didn't seem to.
No, it's
like,
true. I thought he was great in that film.
Really good.
Hey, this is exciting.
Okay.
I'm desperately trying to find some news to justify that.
Well, you ruined it. The biggest news of the week is genuinely that Hugh Grant went to Wimbledon and fell asleep. Can we talk about the trailer for I Swear, which went online Thursday, time of recording?
Today, yeah.
I've seen this film. Helen, you've seen it too. And I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's one of the best British dramas I've seen in a long time. It's a true story about John Davidson from Galloway Shields in Scotland, who has Tourette's. And it's basically his life story. And there are lots of twists and turns. I don't want to ruin any of it here, but he's a really inspiring, fascinating guy. And he's really been through the mill with Tourette's. And he's come out the other side. And it's a great film, I think. And I think a lot of people are going to like it.
He's played here by Robert Aramayo from The Rings of Power, Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power. He is Elrond in that. This is extremely not Elrond. This is like him with, he has Tourette's. He swears a lot. He has uncontrollable physical movements. Mm. He is just, you know, he has a difficult time. So it's a really, really good performance by him. But it's also a very fun trailer, I think. It does, you know, give away quite a lot of the beats in the film, but doesn't give you the whole story. I don't think it spoils too much. It is also a true story. You may have seen documentaries about this guy anyway. But yeah, it's not a bad trailer.
There we go. All right. That'll be out later in the year, I'm guessing. Maybe
October
around the time around the time of the London Film Festival. My God,
yes.
Helen. It's almost as if you read my mind, because the LFF has announced its opening film and I am genuinely excited about it.
Yeah, wake up, James. Deadman. Oh. Listen to this.
Yeah. Mention of U2 once again, because it is going to be Wake Up Deadman, a Knives Out mystery. Still can't believe they're persisting with that title. It should be a Benoit Blanc mystery. Oh, dear Lord. Anyway, Rian Johnson's third Benoit Blanc movie, Wake Up Deadman, is going to open the LFF in October, a couple of months ahead of its release on Netflix, I believe. That's very exciting. That shows a large degree of confidence in this movie, because evidently they must have seen it, right?
Based on the previous two, they should have confidence in it. It's going to be great.
It's my most anticipated film of the year. That I haven't seen.
Okay.
Yeah. So very, very excited about Wake Up Deadman. That's good. It's going to be opening the LFF. And John M. Chu is going to direct Hot Wheels. Okay.
Like tiny cars.
Yeah.
Tiny cars.
What's the story with the tiny
car? I don't know.
My head hurts.
You think there'll be a story?
Why? I don't. How far are we from making Kool-Aid the movie? It feels like not far
enough. We are in the studio at this point, I think. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
We have the answer to the question, how much money did John M. Chu make from Crazy Rich Asians and the Wicked movies? And the answer is evidently not enough. All right.
Maybe he has a killer idea. Maybe this will restore our faith in the raw power
Maybe
of cinema.
He thought he was doing a Hot Ones movie and misread the script.
Well, that would be
also
even worse.
Also not a great idea.
Speaking of bald villains. Anyway. Okay, moving on. Anyway. I did say that we have some very, very sad news to finish off the movie news section. And sadly, we do, because we lost a number of really, really great people last week in the movie industry. We lost Mark Snow, who is the composer of one of the most iconic TV themes of all time, the X-Files theme. There you go. We lost Julian McMahon, who, of course, was in the likes of Nip Tuck, who was...
Charmed.
Yes, I met him. I was charmed. Because I met him when he was Dr. Doom in the Tim Story Fantastic Four movies. And most recently, he was in The Surfer.
He's great.
Well. He was
really good.
Genuinely scary in that film.
Yeah, very scary, yeah.
56, Julian McMahon. He was battling cancer for some time and kept it to himself. And it was very, very sad to see that happen. I remember interviewing him on the first, probably actually both of those movies. And he was really, really great to speak to. And we lost Michael Madsen.
Yeah.
As well.
Absolute giant of a guy.
The great Michael Madsen.
I mean, you know, had been working steadily for years before he kind of broke out in, you know, Thelma and Louise and Reservoir Dogs and kind of stepped up a gear. But, you know, had a really extraordinary personality. If you've ever watched, which I did recently, a lot of Quentin Tarantino documentaries and things like that, he had such warmth and such charisma in his personal life, never mind on screen, you know.
Yeah.
I think I feel like we still didn't get to see his full range as an actor because he did play a lot of tough guy.
Yeah,
he got a lot of tough guy roles. And he was magnificent at tough guy roles, don't get me wrong, but it felt like even that was only scratching the surface.
Absolutely. He was terrific. He was 67 years old. I mean, Tarantino used him, I think, better than anybody. But even then, Tarantino used him mostly in tough guy roles. But when he did, my God, he was great. He was obviously Mr. Blonde in Reservoir Dogs, obviously one of the most iconic scenes of all time where he cut off the cop's ear. He was Bud in Kill Bill. I love him in Kill Bill Volume 2 in particular.
He's so good.
Yeah.
On one hand, like all that sort of, you know, she deserves her revenge and we deserve to die. On the other hand, straight up burying her in a coffin.
Oh, yeah.
Terrifying fate possible.
Yeah, amazing.
Amazing.
We should say about the Reservoir Dogs scene, obviously this is a credit to Tarantino as well, but he is so good in that scene that you think you see him chop off the ear.
Mm. Yeah.
We never see it.
No, yeah, the camera pans off to the left.
But you feel it happening because of his intimidation.
He improved a lot of that stuff. Like a lot of the dance he was supposed to do was, he was not given particular directions in that. He just did his own thing.
He did cut off Turk Baltz's ear.
Yes. And talking into the ear was his thing because Tarantino just said, I'll just throw the ear away. And he was like, well, that's not going to work. And so he did the thing where he's like, hello, hello.
Okay.
Which is particularly sinister.
Really.
Like that scene is so fucking effective. Like even now, I find it quite hard to watch.
Me too. He's also, like a much nicer Tarantino character in Hateful Eight.
Mm.
I mean, by the standards of that film. By the standards of that film, at least, he's one of the warmer
Joe
people,
Gage.
I think it's fair to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe.
Yeah.
And he was sadly cut out of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood as a sheriff.
Yeah, he was great. I interviewed him once for a pint of milk and he was fantastic. And that was in LA. And then a couple of years ago, we were going to do a shoot with him in New York. To celebrate Reservoir Dogs. And I think I can say this now, he did not turn up. He was a bit like James in the first 20 minutes of the podcast.
He was eating banana bread.
Yes, I have a picture of the chair that we had in a warehouse. We found a warehouse in New York and we popped the chair up and we had it beautifully lit. And sadly, he was a no-show, which is a shame. I spent a long time waiting in a warehouse for Michael Madsen. But in a way, I think that's kind of the quintessential Michael Madsen experience. Maybe it's a good thing he didn't show up.
Had his troubles, which I think explains a lot of his filmography and the sheer amount of work that he did or maybe had to do. But he was one of those guys that when he found the right director would be like no one else on earth.
But,
you know, I think unfortunately they were few and far between, but you could see how incredibly unique he was.
He was probably born in the wrong era.
Mm.
Like he was this generation's Robert Mitchum.
But he just wasn't
given those Mitchum roles at all. But, you know, he was a tremendous, tremendous talent. And I interviewed him once and he was everything I wanted. And then he didn't turn up for the second. And in a weird way, that's everything I wanted as well. So Michael Madsen. What if he'd come with the straight razor? I'd have shot myself. I'd have been out of there. I'd have nothing to defend myself at all. But he was great. The late, great Michael Madsen, who passed away this week, at the age of just 67. All right, time for our second guest now. Joseph Kosinski's F1 has been burning up the box office around the world. It has done very, very well. It's one of my favorite films of the year so far. And we have done a spoiler special on that movie, which is going to be up next week on our spoiler special feed, including a full 25-ish minute interview with Joseph Kosinski. But right now, you're going to hear an excerpt from that to wet your whistle. And in case you don't subscribe to the spoiler specials, maybe you would like to. So go to empire.supportingcast.fm to sign up for that and a lot more. Besides stuff that's already there and stuff that's coming over the next few weeks as well. So here we are, me talking to Joseph Kosinski about F1. And yes, from the off, there are spoilers. Martin Brundle-related spoilers. Enjoy. We are delighted to be joined on this F1 spoiler special by the film's director, Joseph Kosinski. How are you, sir?
I am good. I'm good. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. Very, very excited to talk about this movie.
Yeah.
First thing I'm going to throw at you. People might be surprised by the sheer amount in this movie of Martin Brundle.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? As someone who has idolized Brundle for many, many years.
He is an icon. He is an icon of Formula One. I was delighted that I was able to convince him to play himself in this movie. He plays a very important role, as people will see, along with his broadcast partner, David Croft.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about Martin is he's an ex-driver, as yep. fans of him know,
mm-hmm.
And in fact would have driven alongside Sonny Hayes back in the day in the
he
early
would
90s.
Have.
Yes. So I like the idea that he could have the perspective of someone who knows Sonny. he's fantastic in this movie. And for people who know nothing about Formula One, they're going to love having Martin's voice there to kind of help them along and introduce them into the world of this incredible sport.
Do you know, I had never put that together until now, that Brundle would have driven yes. around the same time as Sonny was active in the world of this movie.
Yes, yes.
Because you mentioned, like, he mentions having raced with Prost, with Senna,
yeah, yes.
with Nigel Mansell, who I grew up idolizing as
yes.
well.
Yep.
Brundle was right there.
He was there
well.
Too, yeah.
Did you consider having him act opposite Brad at any point?
This
isn't a Martin Brundle sport, especially. By the
yes.
way,
but. did I consider having a scene with them together? Yeah, maybe at one point there was something. You know, we thought about the Brundle. Walk, yeah. Pre-race walk would have been good. Yeah. But ultimately, yeah. You know, he ended up staying in the broadcast booth and did a fantastic job for us.
Absolutely. Sonny's backstory in this movie is really interesting to me,
mm-hmm.
and you pick and choose your moments to show young Sonny.
Yes.
Startling. I mean, Lola's really coming on. It's incredible. Is it Lola?
It's not
way?
Lola.
No.
It's a company called Metaphysic.
Metaphysic.
Who use a technique where you load in imagery or footage of our actor at the age we wanted him to be. So I think we licensed A River Runs Through It, if I'm not mistaken, loaded
okay.
it into the system,
uh-huh.
and then shot Brad for real. The flashback sequences,
yeah.
and then the software program, obviously with guidance, is able to take Brad back. And having, you know, I have some experience with the digital youthening process, having
mm-hmm.
started my career with
yes.
Tron Legacy.
Yeah.
I know the Uncanny Valley very well. I thought it worked. I thought it was really, really interesting system and worked beautifully for this film.
It's really come on, but I was just fascinated by the way that you deployed it and when you deployed it and how you kind of parcelled out Sonny's backstory.
Yes.
You know, we know that obviously something's gone wrong in his life.
Yep.
We know he's had various issues, gambling, multiple divorces,
yes.
that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But really, I kind of filling in the flaws of the character to the audience was interesting. So
good.
How do you know when to choose those flashbacks, when to deploy those flashbacks,
yep.
and the heart-to-heart he has with Kate on the balcony in Las Vegas
yeah.
is really crucial.
Oh, thank you. We played around, you know, initially I didn't have the hints of that past in the opening scene of the film. It was something that came about later, but I realized that it would be good for the audience to feel that that experience poking through subconsciously, which is why I included it in that opening sequence.
Mm.
And then feathering it through with glimpses in the Will Buxton, speaking of another journalist, he does a little story on Sonny, and then obviously experiencing it through Joshua's eyes as he pulls up the old documentary
yeah.
and watches it, and where he finds out information and deciding to put it right before the Hungarian Grand Prix proved to be the right spot for it, story-wise. The scene on the balcony that you're referring to, that actually came out of a really interesting conversation that Brad and I had with Lewis Hamilton. We were actually here in this hotel, actually. And we had a long script session day. It was like 12 hours, I think, where we went through every line in the script with Lewis. And when we got to the scene where Sonny talks about why it is he races, Lewis opened up to us and shared his experience, which influenced that scene heavily. And that is really Brad putting in his own words what Lewis was describing. And that's something that you could not have gotten, you know, to get it from a 7-time world champion, to hear his experience of what it feels like to be flying, you know, to have
yeah.
that flow state.
Yeah.
In a race car was unbelievable. And to be able to use that in the film was you know, really, I felt honored to do that because that came from a really personal place.
And that really informs, and we're going to, I'm just leaping ahead now to the end, but I was really taken by how you presented it at the end.
Okay.
When Sonny is about to win the race.
Yeah.
And the way you've shot this thing is tremendous. But if I'm right in thinking, you don't show first-person POV on the track until then.
We show it from inside the cockpit. So there are shots where you see the steering wheel and the halo and all that stuff. Uh-huh. But the way that Lewis described it to us, he said the car disappears.
Yes.
And so I put a camera on the front nose of the car for that final lap, which is clear of everything. You don't feel the car at all. You don't see the wheels. And it really, it does have that effect. And then it's the only time where I bank the camera. So if you look closely, you'll see that POV is actually banking around the turns, which is different than the reality of it. It actually does feel more like flying when you do that. And then obviously just kind of pulling the sound down and experiencing it in a much more subjective way was the best way I could feel to describe the sensation that Lewis was talking about.
Yeah, there's a serenity to the moment,
which is how he described it. It's very peaceful. It's very quiet. It's something that now, you know, I think we all want to experience what that's like, you know. I'm glad you responded to that.
So they have 9 races left when Sonny joins the team.
Yeah.
And you show most of those 9 races. There's a couple that you
Yeah, more montage, yes. Yeah.
But can you talk about your visual approach to each one? Were you trying to mix it up for each race?
Yeah, I wanted them each to feel different, you know. So, for instance, Silverstone, there's no music, there's no score in that one. That's pure sound design. Mm-hmm. And then just being the first race, it felt like the one that should feel the most kind of present. Hungary is kind of a chaptered score because we're jumping through the laps with Hans's electronic score there. Mm. Monza, we start dry with no sound, but then bring in the orchestra as the tension builds to the back half when it starts to rain.
Mm-hmm.
Vegas, very subjective race. Again, the sound of the cars is muffled and kind of bubbling underneath Hans's score there. I wanted that one to feel much, you know, that's the one where Sonny's kind of angry.
And it's an angry race, yeah.
Yeah, it's an angry race, and I wanted it to feel angry. So that was different. And then obviously in Abu Dhabi, we've got a mixture of all the different techniques because it's such an epic race and has so many chapters to itself, but ultimately building to the flying moment, which is, you know, from what I like, it's like the character journey, both in terms of plot and in terms of character, both kind of reach their conclusion in the exact same moment. Mm-hmm. And when you can do that in a movie, I think you can build to this moment. It's really powerful in emotion.
Absolutely. In that 12-hour script session that you had, or many of the other script sessions that you had on this movie over the years, what sort of discussions did you have about how it would play out at the end in Abu Dhabi at the final race? Because you could have gone with Joshua winning as well.
We could have gone either way. And we talked a lot about that. Like, you know, which one, you know, Jerry said the problem with racing movies is that the ending, if, you know, if the hero wins, it's predictable. And if he loses, they're disappointed, you know? So it's like, okay, well, the journey there is the most important thing. It's like, you know, the end of Titanic doesn't make the movie any less entertaining.
True.
The journey to get to that final victory for Sonny has to be engaging, has to be unpredictable. In the final race, I really did want to create the situation, and Aaron Kruger writing the script, we tried to create this thing where it's like one of them has to win.
Mm-hmm.
But which one is it going to be?
Yeah.
And ultimately, what I felt made most sense was that Joshua, who's the one who has a whole future ahead of him in this sport, sacrifices his race for the team, which is what he does in that final lap. And Sonny's the one who, from a character point of view, this really is his last shot at getting that victory.
Yeah.
And wouldn't it be great if he could get there? So that to me felt like the right ending for this movie. But certainly, you know, if the audience responds and we get to make another one, it'd be fun to see Joshua's version of that too.
What would you call that movie? You couldn't call it F2.
I know, that's a problem. We slowly, as we get to, you know, through the sequels, we end up in go-karts as we work our way down the classes.
Nobody wants that.
Yeah.
Joseph Kosinski, it's been a pleasure as always. I'll see you down the road.
Okay, that was Joseph Kosinski talking about F1 spoilers. The full podcast will be up next week for spoiler special subscribers. So do yourself a favor, sign up, £3.49 a month, empire.supportingcast.fm for all the goodies, including Team Empire talking about that movie. But right now, it's Team Empire talking about some other movies that are out this week. There's only one movie really in town this week at the multiplexes. That is James Gunn's Superman. Superman, we're going to get to that very, very soon. But there are a couple of other films, a couple of choices for you to watch on your Sofaplex. We're going to talk about them very quickly now. Hells Bells, we said we would review K-pop Demon Hunters. And by God, of the people in this room, you have been true to your word. You've been true to my word that we're going to review that film because I didn't have time to watch it.
And actually watched it. Yes, yes. I did, however. And this, yes. So this is the new Sony Pictures animation. It is directed by Maggie Kang and Chris Applehands and takes from Maggie's Korean background, so hence the K-pop stuff. And also a lot of the stuff, the mythology of this film is based in Korean mythology. So the idea is there are demons, they want to break into this world and like eat people's souls. But yes, centuries ago, a group of three women realized that by singing together and having people join and listen to them and enjoy the music, they could create a sort of shield around the world that would protect us all from the demons.
A suit of armor around the world.
Indeed, exactly, wow. Iron Man.
Yes.
Now, and they have essentially this lineage of sort of singing protectors, guardians, has continued ever since, down to the girl group of Huntrix, who are a trio of Korean women who sing K-pop and are like the biggest band in the world. They're the sort of BTS, but girls of their day. The Blackpink, I guess. I don't
behind
know.
Behind the scenes.
Wow.
Yes.
Anyway, they are coming to the end of another triumphant tour. They're celebrating the launch of their what they think will be their biggest single yet, the one that could really like cement this shield for a generation. And just as they're about to do that, a boy band appears, an evil boy band, actually made up of demons.
So like all the other boy bands? How's that different from...
Oh, now come now. That's very unfair. We all enjoyed the Robbie Williams film last year. You've got to be nice to them now. Anyway, so basically they have to fight an evil boy band of demon hunters through the medium of music.
That'll make them feel blue.
Oh.
Come on.
No. Take that. Look, anyway, this is genuinely a lot of fun. I had a great time with this. It doesn't hang around. It's very pacey. It is a full-on musical. Both bands have bangers of songs.
Good.
And they have taken the sort of John Carney approach of making the songs in their film, you know, genuinely good songs in their own right. I mean, these are really, really fun. I think the soundtrack has already been huge online. And I had a really good time.
And this is on Netflix?
This is on Netflix. Yeah.
Great.
So, yeah, recommend, actually. I think it's probably a high 3, low 4 for us, somewhere in there for me. I think it's, you know, it doesn't have the wild imagination of like a Spider-Verse from the same studio.
Okay.
But it's much, much better than it needs to be. I really had fun.
Sounds good. So K-pop Demon Hunters. So if you're watching Netflix and you've tried to get through The Old Guard 2 and you've given up halfway through, then this is a great option for you.
This is a much better story of fighting evil than The Old Guard 2.
Okay, yeah. Which brings us nicely to The Old Guard 2.
Wow, now, seamless segue.
I know. I should win awards for segueing. I really should. Jimbo.
Yes.
Tell us about The Old Guard 2. And be quick about it, boy.
I'll do my best. So, The Old Guard 1, as you'll recall, came out in 2020. This was Gina Prince-Bythewood's film, and it's based on the Greg Rucka graphic novels, and it starred Charlize Theron as an immortal, the head of a sort of an immortal posse, been around for thousands of years, and they kind of put right problems with the mortal world. I gave this film 2 stars when we saw it. It was during the height of the pandemic. I watched it. I gave it 2 stars. I then very publicly climbed down from that 2-star review, changed the review, rewrote it after having seen the film again and gave it 3 stars. Not in any way controversially, but I didn't love it because it was like, it's a group of immortals who get on the wrong side of Dudley Dursley. And for me, that just wasn't what I was looking for. But that said, I watched it again and thought actually it was a lot of fun. This film, on the other hand, I would give 2 stars to and then possibly go back and change those 2 stars to 1 star at some point and revisit it in that way, because this is not a good film. It's coming 5 years off the original. That's quite a long time to wait for a sequel to a film that wasn't that warmly received to begin with. But this is directed by Victoria Mahoney. Gina Prince-Bythewood was not available for this. Victoria Mahoney did second unit on Rise of Skywalker, but we're not going to hold that against her.
Good movie.
All right, Ben.
It follows on, obviously, from the first one. The first one has a setup at the end where a character who was once lost is now found. Matthias Schoenhart, one of the immortals who betrayed them, has been exiled, which means they're basically just not allowed to be friends with him for 100 years, which is generally hilarious. What's good about the first film is there's a real sense of kind of era-spanning camaraderie between these characters. And I love that. Like the way they interact, the fact that two of them have been in a relationship for like a millennia, it's actually quite touching. And you enjoy spending time with these characters. Mm. Kiki Layne plays Niall, who's like a baby immortal who's just come into her abilities. And so there's some good stuff in the first one. This second one feels like it retreads that ground, but it only pays lip service to it. Like the camaraderie's kind of there, but it feels like a dim echo of it. The actual action sequences are really quite disappointing. Now, you've got Henry Golding, who's an immortal who we've not met before, who's friends with them, he turns up. And then Uma Thurman plays this character called Discord, who's essentially the first immortal, and she's the villain of this piece. And all of that is like by the numbers, relatively disappointing sequel, and that's fine, and it isn't great. But the problem here is not any of those things. The problem here is this isn't a fucking film, because it doesn't have an ending, because this story literally ends at the end of the second act.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You get to the second act, you're about to go to the big confrontation, and it just goes, a film by Victoria Mahoney. And you're like, I'm sorry, what? They just stop the film.
I thought you would have liked it because it feels like a big TV show. It starts like a TV show and ends like a TV show. Why do you not like it?
Except it's like a cancelled TV show, because there has as yet been no indication that there's going to be a third film or we'll ever find out what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And on the grounds of this, on the basis of this, I can't recommend anyone watch this. So it feels like maybe you'll watch Old God 2. If Old God 3 ever comes along and is actually good, then this becomes a slightly laborious introduction to it. But I just don't understand it. There's a big fight with Uma Thurman, which you're like, okay, that was kind of not very good, but it was an amuse-bouche. Except it turns out that's the fucking climax of the film, because it ends. I have rarely been this frustrated by a film experience.
I felt
owe us an ending. If we're putting an hour and a half or nearly 2 hours into this, we deserve to see the end of the story.
Yeah, I would agree. And there's so much more mythology added on this time, and a whole thing about first and last immortals. Charlize Theron has kept the bad haircut, and you know, why? Like, you know, change things up, man. Just mix it up. I find it very, it felt like it made the world smaller, not bigger.
Yeah.
And what's the point of a sequel that seems to make the world smaller? I know there's two new characters, but even so, it just felt, it felt minuscule.
It's very sub-Highlander. Like sub-Highlander 3, not like even sub-proper Highlander.
Sub-Highlander is a TV show.
Hey, don't you come for Adrian Paul.
I'm not.
I was going to say, this is Adrian Paul Highlander, not Christopher Lambert Highlander.
I
actually like Adrian Paul quite a lot.
This is sub the Raven spin-off series.
Yes, that's what it's sub. Okay. Yeah. Nobody's standing for the Raven.
There should only be one, is what you're saying.
Yes, that's right. There can be only one.
Yes. Oh,
and it is not this sequel.
I thought it was desperately disappointing and poorly shot and poorly written. But apart from that, I loved it. We gave this one 2 stars. 2 stars then to the Old Guard 2. Yes. But enough of the amuse-bouche. It is time for the Mighty Bush. That is Superman.
Oh no.
It is time for Superman's Mighty Bush. No, this has gone badly wrong. Helen, tell us about James Gunn's Superman.
Okay. Yes, so this is the first of the new era for DC. David Cornsweet is Superman. We meet him not just media res, but media fight.
I think you find we meet him in Metropolis, but okay. Maybe you don't know comics as well as I do, but it's actually Metropolis and not media res.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, wanted to get that right.
You are the worst.
You looked at me there like I was actually correcting you for a second.
What have I said wrong?
That's all factually accurate, Chris. What are you doing?
Anyway, there's a little textual introduction that sets the scene a tiny bit, but basically they're assuming that you know the biography of one of the best biographied fictional characters in history. Like, you've either seen an episode of Smallville or a previous Superman movie.
Yeah.
And we don't need to give you the whole origin story.
Correct.
So the idea is that he has just lost a fight. He's landed near the Fortress of Solitude, where we first meet his dog, Krypto. He's going to be divisive in this conversation.
Hmm.
And And that kicks things off. There is a big bad pummeling him, and it turns out pretty soon. Oh God! It turns out pretty soon that Lex Luthor, the Nicholas Holt version, is involved in this, and sets a train of events in motion that will involve Lois Lane, played by Rachel Brosnahan, doing some investigative journalism, and not caring if anyone gets in her way or who gets hurt by her investigative journalism. we've got the Justice Gang, led by Nathan Fillion's Green Lantern, Guy Gardner, Eddie Gathegi's Mr. Terrific, and Isabella Merced's Hawk Girl, and a whole lot of other things. Superman has recently tried to stop a war between two nations, and this has proved geopolitically sensitive stuff. So he is now being targeted by the US government as well.
Yes.
I had a good time with this, and I do think there are flaws. I do think it's messy. I think there's too much going on. I'm very much of the keep it simple, stupid school of screenwriting, and this ain't that. But I do think that James Gunn is a good enough writer and director to just about bring things together at the end. I think that the Lex Luthor plot in this film is better targeted at what makes Superman Superman than almost anything else I can think of in Superman screen history. I think it's really, really kind of well thought out. I love the relationship between Corin Sweat and Brosnahan's Clark and Lois. I think that they're both very, very good at those characters. I think Corin Sweat is my best Superman since Reeve, who remains undefeated. And yeah, so while I do have notes about I could have done with a little bit less Krypto and a little bit more Luthor, for example, that kind of thing, I really, really enjoyed this. And I enjoyed it more on a second viewing when some of that kind of madness and kind of manicness of the story kind of settled in for me, and I kind of knew who was who and what was what and what was going on, and then I could just sit back and enjoy it. So I had a good time. But
Well, interestingly, we gave this, I think people listening to this may already know what we've given this.
Yeah.
Empire has given this 2 stars. James, Alex, do you concur?
Well, I do, very much so. But it's interesting because me and Sophie and Alex all saw it in the same screening, and we were all very much of a piece on this film. There have been mixed reviews, I think it's fairly safe to say, but I think they've been more positive than not. We are certainly at the lower end of opinion on this. But I was very, very disappointed with it. So, and this is one of these, and we talked about this a little bit on our spoiler reaction podcast that we did.
I'm
genuinely gobsmacked by how positively people have reacted to it, because I really did think it was a devastatingly disappointing sort of first step into the new era of DC. And look, I'm not as down on the Snyderverse as many, and I will totally give you that the Snyderverse is at times incredibly dour and self-serious and a little bit ill-conceived at times. I don't actually mind that. This, for me, was a wild overcorrection the other way, in that, and this is definitely partly something where it's my sensibility grates against it. It mm-hmm. seems to me that tonally, it has gone for the Saturday morning cartoon version of Superman. And that may be your thing. It is bright, it is colorful, there is a flying dog. It leans into the goofier aspects of DC, which I do not get on with. I also found it sort of tonally and from a character point of view, and even from a story point of view, I found it a little bit shallow and unengaging, and I couldn't really bring myself to care about anything that really happened in it. The media res thing, I understand we don't need a Superman origin story again. We all know what happens, but Sophie's review, I think, is absolutely spot on in this, is that because you don't come up with and you don't see his ascension, you're not engaged, it's really hard to care about what's going on, for me anyway. I couldn't, I understand, like, he has a relationship with his parents, which you do not see into a certain point into the film, his adoptive parents, I should say, the Kents. And the storyline between these two countries, that he's got involved in this war, it all becomes quite mind-boggling to me, because you start off with all of these, and then this happened, and then there's a new era of gods and monsters, and then metahumans here, and then there's two countries you never heard of. And I was like, oh my God, we're 20 seconds into this film, and it is already more of a convoluted muddle than the Snyderverse was after 15 films. And I thought the point of this...
Did you feel that way about The Crawl in Star Wars? Similarly throws concepts at you that you've never heard of, and names that you've never heard of.
I don't think it's the same problem. I get that Star Wars is a story that starts in media res. I completely get that. And I don't even necessarily have an issue with this, but I don't think this does a good enough job of making you follow or really care about what's going on. And it's quite a lot. Like, it's 3,000 years of history condensed into an alarming number of titles at the beginning of the film.
It's like 5 sentences.
And I, we're not doing this again. And, you know, so I really struggled with that aspect of it. But more than that, it's I found the characterization kind of cartoonish and slightly trivial and superficial. I didn't like Lex Luthor at all. I thought the performance was great. I thought the character was wildly two-dimensional and shallow. I really liked Brosnahan and I really liked Corin Sweat. I thought their relationship was the heart of this film. I thought it was the strongest part of the film. There is a scene between the two of them, which is, to my mind, the high point of this entire thing, which is great. And I would have liked to have seen much more of that. I thought Mr. Terrific has a silly name, but he lives up to it. He has a great action scene in this. I really enjoyed him. Nathan Fillion as Green Lantern, also great. Really liked him as well. That it's colourful and not dour is kind of a nice change. But honestly, for me, I found this to be a convoluted mess of ideas, and I just was not happy with it. I'm sorry.
Alex?
I appreciate what James Gunn was going for here. Certainly in that he wanted to pay tribute to, you know, the comics, certain Superman comics and tone of comics and the world of the comics that he was into. And rather than doing a carbon copy of Richard Donner's films, which is what Bryan Singer was transparently doing, although mostly very well. I'm mostly a Superman Returns apologist, but we don't need another one. I like that James Gunn was throwing a lot of madness, a lot of fun, a lot of invention into this film. For me, the problem is that that's sort of all it is. He throws a lot of stuff at the wall to see what sticks, and none of it really stuck for me in any sort of profound way. I did enjoy what he was going for a while. For the first 30, 40 minutes, I thought, this is quite fun. I was quite enjoying it. It's quite fizzy. It's very peppy. I quite liked the dog. I thought Crypto was fun and quite sweet. I don't quite understand why there is a super dog, but that's fine. That's fine. Or why he has a cape. And like you, James, or like Mr. Terrific, I think he's on paper, he's a bit of a run-of-the-mill character, but he's brought to life. I mean, it's funny. He's written with a lot of wit and a lot of attitude, and he's performed by Eddie Gathegi with an obscenely charismatic performance, I think. He really, every time he's on screen, it's a blast.
It's arguable that he has the best action scene in the film.
Mm.
Yeah, and some of the best laughs come from him as well.
Yeah.
I think the rest of his Justice Gang are a bit of a cosplay convention.
I liked Fillion as Guy Gardner. I think Isabella Merced is not particularly well served as Hawkgirl.
Yeah.
I would say.
But yeah, a lot of stuff is thrown at war. I did, about halfway through, I started to tap out when I realized that this wasn't going to be an emotional experience. Because for me, Superman as an on-screen presence needs gravitas and sincerity and real passion. And although the character as written has that, I didn't really feel it in the film. There is a lot of nonsense in this film, a lot of inconsequential ideas. There is one sequence especially that I thought I had a whiff of Attack of the Clones about it. There's just some stuff that happens.
Hang on, five-star sequence.
Yep,
it sounds good to me. Five stars in for Superman. Let's move on.
There is some stuff happens as the film goes on that gets more and more and more fantastical and ungrounded, and it's quite fun, but it doesn't really serve a lot of purpose. And basically none of it really pushed my buttons. I just found it quite impossible at the end of the day to care about anyone in it or anything that happened in it. And like I say, it's not unfun, but when that's all it is for 2 hours, it's like I mean it's mostly gone from my head now because it didn't stir any emotions in me as well. And I think Superman has the potential to be one of the most emotional characters in this whole universe.
Yeah, think about the end of the Donner movie when he loses Lois and you feel the raw power there. Hell's Bells, we'll finish off. We'll come back to you for this. A rebuttal to these two Lex Luthors. What do you feel about that side of the things, the emotional side of things? Gunn cultivated a reputation for a long time as a very cynical, glib writer and director who stayed away largely from emotion. But then his Guardians movies,
soaked
in it. Yeah, absolutely dripping with emotion. What do you think about the emotional side of this? Do you think that Gunn was the right fit for it? Because, of course, he's the head of, along with Peter Safran, he's the head of DC Films.
Yeah.
He wrote this. He wasn't initially going to direct it.
Yeah.
Then he wrote it. took his screenplay to the head of DC Films, James Gunn, who said, "This is great, no notes. Who do you think should direct it?" And the head of DC Films, James Gunn, said to the writer of Superman, James Gunn, "I think you should direct this." Which is obviously not entirely what happened. But do you think that he was a good choice to direct his own script, or would someone else have unlocked the emotion, or was the emotion unlocked for you anyway?
The emotion was there. It's not the most emotional Superman movie to me. I would agree with that. I would concede that. But I think it was there. Now, full disclosure, I did speak to James Gunn last week for Dumb
Here we
B.
go.
Yeah.
You're a crypto bro.
Wow. Okay. That's insulting. But yes. But he said literally this is always his process, that he always writes it as if he's not going to direct it and then falls in love with it while writing it and then can't imagine anyone else doing it. I do think actually almost that there maybe are times where another set of eyes coming in and, you know, maybe, like I say, stripping it back a bit for me would have been preferable. I would have loved more scenes with Lois and with Lex and with Superman slash Clark. And that, to me, would have taken it up to a 4 or 5. For me, it's at least a high 3, low 4. It's somewhere in there for me, personally, not obviously Empire.
A high 3, a lowest 4.
A lowest 4, yes. Yeah. But I did feel the emotion, and I thought that you get that in that early scene. You've seen some of it in the trailers, but you know, where Superman is kind of defending himself for going across borders and stopping a war in protection of international law. and he's saying people were going to die. I had to act. And you get that passion that he has. Like he cannot, he feels like he cannot let bad things happen to anyone on his watch. If it's his watch, he has to kind of be the one who's there and protecting people. Mm. And that, to me, is the essence of the character. And so I just love those kind of moments. I thought really, really worked. Yes, I will concede it's not the most emotional Superman movie, and maybe a few more sets of eyes on it, like I say, would have helped that. Mm. But I don't think it is bad. And I do think the emotion is there. And I got it in moments like... A couple involving the dog, actually. I thought you got the sense that this is a guy who cares for everybody, even the world's worst dog, you know?
Well, he admits that the dog is a bad dog.
He says it's a bad dog.
Not least of all because it's not a real dog, but yes.
Well, yeah, it's a real dog. It's just from Krypton.
The effects are very good.
It's a CGI dog.
It's a very, very good piece of CGI.
Yes, very, very good.
That's really genuinely fantastic work.
Yeah. The dog's real, but Corin Sweat's entirely CGI.
I think the problem for me is that it never really stops to breathe. You know, it hits a certain point tonally and then just stays there for 2 hours. And I did feel a bit numb to that, basically.
It's an interesting choice, though, isn't it? Because, like, to a certain extent, this refresh, this reset of DC from the DCEU was in part response to, you know, a tonal shift. But also, the DCEU had become quite...
Yeah.
Bogged down and convoluted. And same with the comics often do these refreshes when it starts to buckle under the weight of its own mythology, it resets. I thought it was a bold choice. I'm not sure it was a good choice to almost begin this with something that is already quite heavy with plot and characters and background and world. Like there's a lot going in. And I think one of the downsides to that approach is it's not the most accessible film, I don't think, in that, you know, Superman, certainly the Donner ones, I think have that advantage that they're so easy to get on board with. You don't need to be into comic book movies. You don't need to be into anything. There's a purity to it. There's so many on-ramps to that film. I think this film is less approachable, less accessible to people, which is why I think it's an odd thing to begin this new universe with.
Well, we shall see where it goes, because that is all the time we have, I'm afraid, to discuss Superman. We have recorded a immediate reaction spoiler special, which will be up today as well. That's the three of us plus Amon Warman talking about the movie. That is going to be available. There's so much happening in this movie. We were only able to cover about 40% of it. So there will be a second part, which will be out maybe next week. We shall see. And then we do have a spoiler special interview as well with James Gunn, which will be out in a couple of weeks' time, which we get into some of the big revelations in the movie. But right now, as you can see, it is divisive. It is divided this room. It is divided the office. It's divided a lot of people out there. Let us know what you think as well. But please don't shout at us if you think we're terrible. 2 stars then for Superman, which is in cinemas right now. And on that note, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by Alex Cox, the original host of Movie Drome, and of course the director of Repo Man, and Matt Shakman, director of The Fantastic Four First Steps. Very, very exciting indeed. But Until then, until that auspicious occasion, until we meet again, it is time to say goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning and Albie. Bye, Albie.
Bye.
Bye. How was it?
Good.
Okay, good stuff, Albie. Thanks a lot. We can release Albie. That is excellent.
From his torment.
From his torment. Alex Godfrey, goodbye.
I've been super. Thanks for asking.
You have been super, man. This has been really, really great. It's goodbye from James Dyer.
Ruler of Australia.
Son of Al-Jaida.
Who is this Superman? It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
You've got me. Who's got you?
And it's goodbye from me. I want to dedicate this podcast to Andre Silva and Diogo Jota. You'll never walk alone.